telling her that desire was lost in an inaccessible realm didn't seem politic at that moment. "Do we have a deal?" "Yes, we have a deal," she said, "except for one wrinkle. Earlier today, when I discovered War on the summit of the volcano, asking after the Ring of Silence, I grew concerned. So I sent it away for safekeeping until I could determine why you'd come."
"What do you mean?" his voice rumbled, but Merritt didn't so much as flinch.
"Before I met you outside the caravanserai, I sent the Ring of Silence west by Dragonwing. Given your reputation, you might have tried to take it by force of arms. Being clever, I thought to put it beyond your reach. You're telling me the Ring of Silence is not here?"
"I sent it out past the borderlands for safekeeping, into the strange."
Chapter 20. Regent. Elendine, Queen of Hazurium.
"Sark are heading this way, Your Majesty," said the scout. "They know we're here."
Elendine bit into the yellow fruit whose name she didn't know as she listened to the scout's alarming report. Juice exploded in her mouth, slightly sweet but mostly bitter. "Appropriate," she mused. Navarre had warned against choosing a regent in haste. Once again, Elendine regretted her hot-headed decision to ignore the First Protector's advice. To Navarre's credit, no recriminations had been offered. Yet. Opportunities for I-told-you-sos would present themselves after they emerged from this latest unfolding disaster, assuming they made it through and didn't disappear into the fetid green wilds without a trace. Since Elendine's expedition had no business being anywhere near the green wilds, no one was going to come looking for them in the tumult of giant trees, poisonous snakes, and numberless sark any time soon. Especially with a regent sitting on Hazurium's throne with what Elendine pictured as a secret smug smile on her face.
Damn it! This was all Brandolin's fault. If her mother hadn't dashed off to pursue her latest cause, whatever the hell it actually was, Elendine wouldn't have been wearing the crown. Why couldn't Brandolin have finished out her reign with dignity and wisdom and let Elendine grow into the position for a few more years?
But things were as they were. What a rude awakening to learn that merely having that title of queen didn't protect one from a series of wrong, some might call them disastrous decisions. Being angry helped her through the bad times, but it was no substitute for steering clear of poor policy in the first place.
Damn Brandolin!
After War duped Elendine and escaped with the Ring of Peace, the queen fell into a depression the like of which she'd never previously endured. She finally gave in to the inevitable. She retreated to the Queendom of Hazurium to lick her wounds and to mourn her sister Flora. At least that had been the plan. But the passing months didn't dampen her flame. They fed her anger. Say one thing about Queen Elendine. Say she holds a grudge like no other. So after the worst of feeling sorry for herself had passed, Elendine allowed the rage to ramp up once more. She vowed revenge on the betrayer. Deposed incarnation of War or not, no shading piece of dragon shit was going to get the better of the Queen of Hazurium. So she'd raised a host of peacemakers, pardoned criminals, and the cream of the adventuring companies Hazurium was famous for hosting. Doing so dangerously weakened the standing force that guarded the city. That hadn't been her worst error, because right before leaving, she gave in to her counselor's recommendation. She installed someone to rule in her stead, in case she was gone for an extended period. Regent Shari Marana. Shari was Elendine's cousin, and a noble in her own right in the neighboring kingdom of Mandariel. As regent, Shari had promised fidelity and honor in the queen's absence. Instead of doing any of that, Regent Shari had somehow arranged for Elendine and her host shipping across the blue stretches of Oceanus to sail directly into the teeth of the most wicked storm to lash the great sea within the memory of any living sailor. Some might call it bad luck. Of course, they didn't know the gift Elendine had received in the throne room prior to her departure from Azurium. Regent Shari had bowed respectful and fawning as any handmaiden. She described how her agents had made a secret rendezvous with the Oracle in Telenbar. Everyone knew the Oracle's predictions were never wrong. The trick was getting her to provide a prognostication in the first place. Somehow, Shari had managed it. So caught up in the preparations of departure, Queen Elendine never questioned the veracity of the document containing the Oracle's supposed prognostication. She'd been taken in by Shari Marana's downcast eyes and her explanation that the gift was merely something any subject would offer her queen setting off on a dangerous quest. The document laid out a timetable describing when the most auspicious sea crossings might be made over Oceanus for the next few months. It described when good winds and weather would be assured for Elendine and her army to take ship. Elendine, already feeling the sting of too little time, was happy to shift her original timetable a few more days in order to sail through the prognosticated window, when they could expect the best winds and weather to see them across the sea in record time. Who would have guessed waves could grow so tall? It was as if Oceanus had gained a malign will of its own that night. It tried to shake off all who inched across its wind-torn, wave-lashed skin. The queen's armada was shattered. The storm had been more terrifying than the fight during the Crayfall at the Moondor. Then, at least, she had been able to fight for her life. Against the angry sea, swords mattered little. One could only scream imprecations. Of course, all words, prayers, and curses had been instantly drowned in the rack and boom. Half the ships Elendine led out of Azurium went down with all hands, including the vessels transporting their mounts. The survivors were blown west, only to break up on the rocky cliffs of Oceanus's southwestern shores. So Elendine had assembled the survivors. All told, including herself and Devar the First Protector, she counted just over 1,000 able warriors still strong enough to test the walls of Mageddon. The remaining survivors, those too hurt or too depleted in spirit to continue, she ordered to the queendom's nearest outpost instead of back to Hazarium. As much as she wanted Shari Marana to know that her scheme had failed and that the true queen of Hazarium yet lived, she decided to lay low. If all her enemies thought her dead when she finally gathered her forces, she could strike with devastating surprise. But of course, things were already off to a bad start. The salvaged carts, containing supplies enough to feed her much-reduced force, continually broke or got mired in the rough, roadless terrain. Three warriors had succumbed to some kind of poisonous asp. 10 had come down with shakes from forest fever. Heat stroke culled dozens more, and now the scout had returned with news of Sark headed their way. "How many?" Navarre asked the scout. A woman dressed in gray and brown leathers with a scar that ran from the edge of her left eye across her face. The scout shrugged. "A dozen?" She appeared not the least impressed at being asked to give a report directly to Queen Elendine and the First Protector in the Royal Pavilion. On the other hand, the Royal Pavilion was hardly more than a large tent. The scout added, "But there could be more. Those curves can cut through the forest like water past rocks in a stream. If I'd gotten closer, they'd have seen me certain as winter." Elendine had fought Sark before. Vicious, debased, and graceless, the fallen Kephlum were hardly more than animals, and rumored to be driven by the quiescent sound of the sinner himself. It made her shiver to think on that connection overlong. The idea that Sark were once Kephlum at all seemed absurd on its face. But Elendine knew it was true.
They'd lost any grace they might have once possessed, and wore only clothing made from the hides and scalps of their victims. They'd forsaken dignity and possibly even their sanity.
"How soon will they arrive?" Ellendine said, putting images of the vile creatures from her mind.
"Assuming they keep moving at their current pace and speed, they're less than an hour from our camp."
Navarre saluted the scout. The scout squinted at the first protector in confusion and gave something that was halfway between a wave and salute in return. Had the scout been a peacemaker, she'd have known she'd just been dismissed. But she was from one of the companies who joined the expeditions in hope of finding fabulous loot in Mageddon and just stood there.
"Thank you," said Ellendine. "Please alert your troops and any other unit leaders you see to expect company."
"Sure," said the woman, finally realizing the situation. Before ducking under the flaps, the scout snatched a piece of fruit from a silver platter. The platter had been set by Ellendine Senchel, who remained more concerned with maintaining etiquette than the reality of their situation. Navarre studied the floor of the tent, staying silent, but not for long. By her posture, Ellendine knew what was coming, so Ellendine got the jump on her first protector.
"Don't say it. We're pressing forward."
Navarre's ears flattened fractionally. Only because Ellendine had spent so much time with her did she recognize it. The first protector's body language screamed disapproval. Ellendine felt slightly ashamed of all the horse dung she'd made the first protector swallow. Navarre was only trying to live up to her duties, but so was she.
"Listen, for all we know," said Ellendine, "the betrayer was behind Shari's duplicity. Either way, War's spies have likely reported to him that Queen Ellendine and her retinue are dead, which means his guard is down. We can't let this opportunity go past without seizing it. You would do the same, were you given to rule over the queendom. Our forces are only a quarter of what they were.
And still twice what we need if we strike from surprise."
"Maybe."
"It's a maybe we won't get to try again any time soon. If we're successful, we will do more than secure the ring of my ancestors. We will cleanse our dean of the betrayer. All the Daylands will be safer for his removal, not merely Hazirium. You know it's true."
Navarre shook her head and said, "I've offered all my arguments. I won't offer them anew, because I know your mind is made up. My apologies."
Ellendine smiled. "None necessary.
Let us see to the approaching Sark threat. If we survive that, we can assess our best route through the Green Wilds. We'll need to resupply before venturing across the Glass Desert or skirt it. We did not count on that as our original route."
Ellendine nodded. She said, "If our enemies knew we'd survived in the first place, they won't guess we'd tracked south through the tangled paths, or that we'd spill out onto the Killing Glass. We have an advantage. We should use it."
She stood, grabbed her sword, then paused a moment to admire the fine runes glittering along the blade. Without the Ring of Peace, her power was lessened. But Renswandir remained as deadly as ever. It was particularly good at dispatching Sark and scheming regents. She said, "I wonder what that bitch Shari is doing right now." The first protector deigned not to answer. Ellendine girded the sword to her waist. "Round up a detachment to ambush those damn Sark before they reach us."
"Of course."
Ellendine put a hand on Navarre's arm before she lifted a flap to exit the pavilion, then pointed at the platter.
"You should have one, while they're still fresh. The taste is tolerable, satisfying even."
"Later, Your Majesty."
"Your loss."
Ellendine enjoyed another few bites of the yellow, bitter fruit.
Chapter 21 Nightstar. Carter Morrison. The crew of Nightstar, delighted in setting rats on fire just to watch how far the shrieking things could run across the glass before expiring. Nightly, degradations occurred down in the prisoner's hold where desperate captives were shackled. Hazing was also popular. New crew members were ambushed in some dark corner of the ship and beaten within an inch of their lives, while onlookers laughed themselves sick. Captain Timon wasn't present for any of these particular episodes, or half a dozen similar incidents that occurred daily on his ship. But he might as well have been the one holding the torch, the whip, or the rope. His implicit permission for every and any atrocity perpetrated by his crew gave the worst among them an excuse to indulge in depravities they were unlikely to have attempted on their own. That's how I saw it. And for me, it wasn't academic. I fucking hated Timon, despite not having seen his face in a couple of months since I'd come aboard. Things would have been bad enough, but several of Kadir's comrades remained on Nightstar. They were none too happy that their friend had been forced off the ship. They'd selected me as the target for their dissatisfaction. From their perspective, Mevish was too scary to hassle, and Saraja had come under the captain's eye, potentially, as his new first mate. Which left me. And who was I? A stranger. Found on the glass, who should by all rights be shackled down with the other captives to be sold as a slave the next time Nightstar visited the Citadel of the Harrowing. Saraja saw to it that I had a hammock and a daily allotment of the slop that each pirate was due. She also provided me with a safe in her own cabin where I kept Yusher. I worried that if I kept that odd object on my person or in my bunk, someone would steal it. But Saraja was also kept busy by her new duties, so I hardly ever saw her. Mevish made it clear I was not to come anywhere near her or our deal was off. Which left me pretty much on my own. At first, that seemed ideal. I figured that I'd spent the first week or so just trying to understand how things worked on Nightstar. And more importantly, trying to delve into my newly revealed Ardeen-given talents and memories. Then, once things settled a bit more, I'd planned on getting the hell out of Dodge. Things hadn't proved so easy. Finding more than a few minutes of time to myself was insanely difficult. Several pirates shared my bunk on alternate sleep shifts from me. So I couldn't retreat to the hammock for private time other than during the 5 hours sleep shift I had to myself. The bosun seemed to know exactly where I'd next try to hide from him, so as to avoid some back-breaking job or other that he delighted in handing out. And keeping ahead of Kadir's many comrades was a full-time job in itself. And that's when I learned about the hazing. Limper, one of the pirates who shared my hammock on alternate sleep shifts, was a greasy, smelly man. He walked as if perpetually drunk, though his rolling gait was actually due to an injury and thus his name. Of course, he always was inebriated, which didn't help. Limper was also the keeper of the maps. Instead of taking his place in the hammock we shared when my turn came around, I followed him up to the main deck. I was almost dead on my feet and too tired to think straight, but I'd finally realized he'd know Nightstar's route better than anyone, which meant he'd know the ship's closest approach to the edge of the glass desert. Limper made his wavering way to the stern, and I followed. I wanted to talk to him when no one else was around. I didn't want to invite curiosity about my interest in our route. Someone might guess my actual intent to escape my duties as a privateer. I caught my quarry at the very rear of the ship, along a sort of narrow catwalk that skirted the stern castle. The sun had set a few minutes earlier, but the warmth radiating up from the glass below was still palpable. Limper had out his charts, maps, and a sextant.
I was surprised a sextant worked in Ardeen, but there it was.
"Hey, Limper, got a minute?" I said.
Only after addressing him with the name everyone else used did my newfound facility for knowing what people are called reveal his birth name, Alizado. Limper Alizado flinched, jerking the sextant away from his eye. Seeing me, his eyes narrowed.
"You shouldn't be here."
"I know, I should be sleeping. Shit, I'm tired. But I wanted to talk to you first. I hear you're a master with the maps, no one better. I was hoping you could help me." Yes, I was resorting to flattery.
He scowled, "As if I'd help you. Get away from me, demon."
Not the response I'd expected, and it knocked me back on my heels.
"Hey," I said,
not particularly eloquent, but better than the response I'd swallowed, "I'm not a demon."
"Bad enough, I gotta share my hammock with the moon taint who got Kadir, bravest son of the Maker, thrown off Nightstar. Not my choice."
"But I don't have to stain my ears with anything out of your mouth, or look at you." He turned back to his equipment. Another member of Kadir's fan club. How such a bully had won over so many friends, I couldn't imagine, but there it was. Limper wasn't going to willingly speak with me, let alone help me, unless I helped him see the merit of my cause. And really, wasn't Limper just an outgrowth of the code I'd written to create Ardeen? Yes, he was, which meant I could directly tweak his attitude. And in doing so, I argued with a part of me subtly concerned with where this was going, I wasn't so much overriding the will of a conscious being as making a few adjustments to eliminate bugs. Right? I promised myself that I'd wrestle with moral implications later and concentrated, looking for Limper's true name. Alizado was only part of the greater truth making up the man. A hand fell on my shoulder and squeezed hard before I discovered anything more about Limper. The hand spun me around into the foul breath of someone three times my size. It was Big Toma. Bad news. Another Kadir stalwart. In fact, Big Toma was still openly bitching about Kadir's absence. No one else would dare talk so openly against Captain Timon's decision. But Big Toma was either too stupid, or too sure of his own strength, or both to keep his tongue in check. And now he had me in one of his oversized hands. Big Toma said,
"You're that new prick, right? Just joined the crew. What's your name?"
He grabbed me around the neck and squeezed.
"Cart, oof!"
I wheezed with what air I had left. He'd caught me off guard. I wasn't getting enough oxygen.
"Cart, that's a funny name. Well, Cart, you ain't faced the Red Mast of Valor, have you? You can't be one of us if you ain't gone through what the rest of us done."
"Yeah," Limper chimed in. "I shattered my leg 'cause of the Red Mast, but I survived. I proved myself. This little fish has got to do the same."
"Yep," agreed Big Toma.
He turned and padded back around the stern castle, dragging me behind him like a piece of luggage. Trying to breathe with his fingers still clutched around my neck made me wheeze. He only squeezed harder when I tried to pry them loose. People around the ship looked up as Big Toma pulled me into view. I was like a doll to him, and I worried he was about to try to pull out my stuffing.
"Hey," I gasped, or tried to. It came out as a croak. "Get Saraja or Mevish or the captain. Toma isn't acting on orders."
A cackle of laughter went up. A dozen eager, grinning faces congregated as I was hauled across the deck. Amid the gabble of their voices, one phrase was repeated often in eager tones.
"Red Mast of Valor.
Fuck." I had no idea what that was, but any sort of hazing that left an able-bodied man with a limp for the rest of his life was not something I wanted to face. Big Toma finally stopped amidships, beneath the mainmast. The mast was a rusty sort of red color, which, until that moment, I'd failed to realize. When my captor let go of my neck, it was only so he could jerk me up by my ankle. He lifted me entirely off the deck, upside down. I could only cough and gag. With his free hand, he wrapped the end of rope hanging from the mast around my leg several times, then pulled the cord tight. The world went topsy as blood rushed into my head. Big Toma tied the line off with an elaborate sailor's knot to the cheers of the onlookers. The wrapping dug painfully into my calf. No sense of decorum, dignity, or the barest idea of a plan remained in my head. I was near to blubbering. "What are you doing?" I gurgled. "Making sure you don't fall, little birdie," said my tormentor. "You're going to dangle from the spar where the sails hang for a while. Time to show us your valor, birdie." The phrase, "hang him from the yardarm," whispered through my brain. I'd always thought it was something they did for executions. "Oh, no, don't!" I screamed. But I was already being hauled skyward, head down and feet to the sky. The deck fell away in a series of jerks, each one tightening the rope's grip around my leg. More blood pooled in my head, making me feel even more thick and ineffectual. Paradoxically, a sense of fullness and loss of agency also calmed my panic. I clamped my mouth shut and stopped begging. It wasn't doing any good. I tried pulling my knees up towards my chest as I bent at the waist. The bumping and jerking made it almost impossible, but I managed to bend and strain upward, getting a hand on the massive knot Big Toma had tied. My leg was already going numb. The mass of rope around my leg wasn't so much a knot, I saw, as it was a tourniquet. If this was what had happened to Limper, I was surprised he hadn't lost his entire limb. Having reached a height nearly equal to the topmost spar, Toma tied off his end of the rope around a deck stanchion. He yelled up, "Get comfortable! There you hang till sunrise, birdie!" Apparently, calling me birdie was considered the height of wit based on the roar of delight the lout got each time he said it. Tuning out the laughter and crude suggestions below, I tried to figure out how to undo the knot. Hanging upside down, leg going numb, and blood pooling in my brain were factors working against me. Not to mention that it was dark. My fingers fumbled over tight coils and loops of rope I could hardly see. My heart was pounding, and I could hardly breathe. Was I dying? And yet, through my panic, new knowledge trickled into me. Just as I'd somehow known the names of nearly everyone I'd interacted with so far in Ardeen, I knew this rope. More than merely the rope, in fact. Unless my blood-flooded brain was feeding me hallucinations, I knew the mast, the air I was breathing, even the gravity that pulled me downward. The laws of Ardeen momentarily shuddered into view before my awestruck eyes like illustrations of moving gears within gears within gears. I gasped. The vision was like another key in the lock of my memory, or at least the memory of someone I might have once been. The Maker handed out rings to those who became newly embodied incarnations of death, war, lore, and desire. To them was given a chance to be gods of a fresh reality merely by accepting simple bands of metal. It was that or face annihilation. When Ardeen first formed to buffer Earth from the strange, planetivores were already halfway through the rift. We'd had to stop them, and together we did. But the details were faded to begin with, and grew hazier the more I strained after them. "Holy shit," I croaked. I'd been something amazing, something unimaginable. Well, actually, something straight out of a comic book. The memory of the experience was overwhelming. The vision crashed. Tears welled in my eyes, but rolled up my forehead.
Maybe a version of me had once been something amazing here in Ardeen, but I was just a guy hanging from the yardarm for the amusement of a boatload of jeering pirates. Except a little something remained after my unexpected recollection, like a tickle on the back of my brain. I focused on the rope. When I did, I suddenly understood a bit more of its underlying essence and the simple geometries of the knot Big Toma had tied. It wasn't as impossible to decipher as it first seemed. I pulled the tangle of cords there, pushed here, and prodded there. The knot fell open like a solved puzzle box under my fingers. The rope loosened. My leg came free, and gravity jerked downward. I grabbed for the mast and found a tangle of line to hold as I flipped end for end. Maybe a little bit of the elan I'd used to untie the knot was still in my hands, because I can't otherwise imagine how the flip and pull didn't rip me free of my purchase and dash me onto the deck. I did sprain my wrist for my trouble, and the pins and needles of the blood returning to my leg was quickly becoming fiery. If Jusher hadn't been safely stored with Saraja, the sphere would have shaken loose and probably shattered planking on the deck. "Better stay up there, Birdie," someone bellowed from below. "Your time isn't up." Twilight approached, but I could still see a dozen faces looking up at me. One of them, standing on top of the stern castle, was that bastard Captain Timon. It was too dark and far for me to see his expression. Not that I could read a Keflum's face, but his body language was plain. He was amused. He'd watched the whole thing go down and hadn't done a thing to stop it. Did I mention Captain Timon wasn't my favorite? The Keflum saw my regard. He whistled to get his crew's attention and said, "You've had your fun. The new meat faced the red mast of valor better than most of you. Now let him down without harm, or you'll be the next one sent aloft. And it won't be your leg the rope is tied to." General grumbling followed this command. I waited for some outburst from the huge man who'd run me up, but even he kept his tongue. I peered down the mast. His glare transmitted undisguised hatred. Crap. I was going to have more trouble with Big Toma before all was said and done, but not right then, because he ducked his head and walked away. I climbed down under my own power, but only after my leg woke enough for me to feel the stubby rings on the side of the mast. By the time I was back safely on deck, it was almost completely dark. Several lanterns and a few torches provided warm light. Most of the crew had disappeared. Timon hadn't moved. And when I looked at him, he said, "You're more competent than you look." I replied, "Or luckier." "Maybe. Either way, I wonder if my ship is the right place for you." His ears swiveled on his head. My heart sped up. Was he offering me a chance to leave or threatening to take my life? With Timon, it could go either way. He remained quiet and watched me, and I realized he was waiting for some kind of answer. "Well," I temporized, "I admit the incident with the hanging from the mast has soured me a bit on Nightstar. Most of your crew dislikes me. They blame me for Kadir being sent away." "Kadir," he said in a musing tone. "Then, come to my cabin. I have a job for you and a couple of others. If you manage it, I'll let you leave Nightstar alive, not in slaves' chains at the next port we put in." He turned and went into the forecastle structure where he kept his cabin. I stumbled up the steps, favoring my tingling leg, and followed him inside. The captain's cabin was lushly appointed with gold, silks, and leather. Surprisingly large, too, making me wonder if it was larger on the inside than outside.
Such magic was certainly possible in Ardeen. Besides Captain Tymon, the palatial chamber held Siraja, my benefactor, and Mevish, she of the twining hair and deep secrets. I couldn't read Siraja's Kephlem features, but Mevish's eyes held at least as much disdain for me as Big Toma's had. I wondered if I'd fallen out of the pan and into the fire.
"Carter," said the captain.
"Interesting choice of name. Did your mother choose to name you after that ancient myth, Carter Strange? Or did you take it because you thought to make yourself seem more than you are?" I sputtered. Tymon didn't notice my response. He didn't really want to know. He'd just been offering niceties, such as they were. The captain continued, "I've got a special task for you three. You can think of it as an opportunity, if you like, because if you succeed, all of you will get something you want. Carter will go free. Siraja will become my first mate, in truth. And to Mevish, well, that'd be telling." "Opportunities aboard Nightstar are always welcome, Captain," said Siraja, ears attentive.
"I'm sure. But I want you to know that the assignment is also punitive. If you fail, you'll certainly die."
"Why punitive?" I said. "Because you three cost me my last first mate, and that has repercussions. I never thought Siraja had it in her to defeat Kadir, my mistake, which makes me look weak, and I can't have that. I should have killed all of you the moment you came back aboard."
Mevish hissed, "But here we are, still alive."
"Don't interrupt. But yes, resources are scarce on the glass desert. I'd be a fool to waste your lives, especially if I can put them to use." The direction this was going worried me. Siraja lifted her lip to reveal canines.
"You mean to send us into the singing crater?" yelled Mevish suddenly.
In response, the captain smiled like the cat who ate the canary.
"Singing crater," I said.
"You'll see," said the captain, "tomorrow."
Chapter 22 Computation. Catherine Manners. The orange taxi pulled up outside the sprawling Federal University of Paraná, Brazil. The main structure reminded Kate of the White House back in the USA. Lots of white columns, windows, pomp and circumstance.
"Obrigado," Raul told the taxi driver, handing over several colorful bills.
The car sped off, leaving Catherine wondering which door they should enter by. Various signs seemed promising, but she couldn't read them. Before she applied for a visa to visit Brazil, she hadn't even known that Portuguese was the country's official language. She was embarrassed to remember she'd assumed it was Spanish. A man with black-rimmed glasses and neatly trimmed gray hair noticed them from the steps. He yelled, "Hola!" and waved them over.
"Is that Claudio?" said Raúl.
"Must be," she said. They waded through the sea of students to the steps. Liza Banks had provided their contact, one Claudio Rodriguez, who worked in the Federal University Computing Lab, spoke English, and was amenable to showing an American Silicon Valley investor around the newly founded Next Generation Computer Research Facility the university was building.
"You must be Ms. Manners," said Claudio, beaming. "And you're Señor Rodriguez."
The man's smile widened with delight.
"Yes, indeed I am. I am so glad to make your acquaintance, but please call me Claudio."
His command of English was so perfect that his accent was hardly noticeable. But when he said Claudio, the name sounded to her ears more like Claudio. Claudio looked at Raúl. "And this is?"
Raúl smiled,
turning up the amperage to match their host. He extended his hand and said, Glad to meet you, Vic Tansler. I'm hoping what you've got here is as exciting as what we've been led to believe, because I've got Angel Investment Cash gathering dust in an index fund. An index fund, dude. Boring. I can't tell you how awesome it would be to put those greenbacks to work on something exciting. Something like a, I hear you've got cooking down here in Brazil.
Kate's mouth fell open. Raul's Mexican accent was gone, replaced by an overcooked L.A. surfer accent.
Awesome?
Claudio blinked a few times, apparently as taken aback at Vic's enthusiasm as Kate. Kate jumped into the breach and said, "Didn't Liza tell you? Things were moving so fast, I guess our wires got crossed. Mr. Tansler has joined our group. You can probably see why. So yes, if we like what we see, then we're ready to move with investment papers immediately, maybe even today."
Oh, comprehension dawned. Oh, well, that would be wonderful. Though the formal tour of the facility isn't scheduled until tomorrow.
Raul clapped Claudio on the shoulder and said,
"I didn't get where I am by wasting time while the sun's up, dude. All of us only have so much time on this earth, and I only want to spend part of the days left for me on business. Know what I mean?"
"I guess. Well, maybe not."
"Dude, listen,"
Raul squeezed Claudio's shoulder for emphasis.
"Is there any way you could let us take a peek early? Like right now? I'd really appreciate it."
Kate suppressed a flinch at hearing yet another dude emerge from Raul's lips. She even gave Claudio a conspiratorial wink. Claudio's earlier enthusiasm snuck back onto his face. Their combined effort to sway him seemed to be working. Claudio said,
"Well, sure, why not? I have a key card. I suppose it wouldn't hurt to give you a preliminary tour." "You're a prince, dude."
Claudio gave a nervous laugh, then said, "Follow me." Kate and Raul fell into step behind their new guide. Kate elbowed Raul in the ribs and whispered,
"Lay off the surfer persona."
"Why?" Raul whispered back. "He's buying it."
"Because otherwise I'm going to punch you in the face, dude."
Raul grinned. Claudio led them through a series of hallways flooded with students and teachers. Kate smelled books, fried food, and that indefinable scent of aged leather and dust that fills so many places of learning. Her cell phone rang. She plucked it from her purse and saw Liza Banks' name. Kate answered, "Hello? Make it quick. We're heading towards the facility right now." Banks' voice came over the line. "You work fast. Well, I want to let you know that things are moving forward back here, too. We might even have a new asset for the initiative."
Remind me, which initiative are you talking about?"
Banks had cooked up several. Ahead of her, Claudio paused before a heavy metal door and started going through his pockets, presumably looking for a key card to fit the reader.
"The estate initiative," Liza said, exasperation clear in her tone. "Oh, right."
Liza, Paldridge, Raul, and Kate had discussed dozens of scenarios for scrubbing the quantum code from the internets. Kate had also revealed, with Raul's reluctant blessing, Raul's claim to be from an alternate dimension, or a recursion, as Raul insisted on calling it. Instead of being shocked and feeling betrayed like Kate, or even being even the least bit incredulous of his claim, Liza Banks got excited. She'd been specially taken with the idea that Raul was part of a secret organization that dealt with cross-recursion difficulties. Banks suggested Earth needed a similar sort of body, a group with more structure and resources than the ragtag team that she, Paldridge, Raul, and Manners represented. Kate had agreed in principle, but said that it was something to worry about later, after she and Raoul dealt with the active research project in Curitiba. Apparently, Banks hadn't listened. Raoul leaned his head close and whispered,
"Everything all right?"
Kate shrugged and shushed Raoul with a finger to her lips. Meanwhile, Claudio found the card he was looking for and swiped it through the reader. The red light on the reader turned from red to green. Banks said something, but screeching hinges from the opening metal door was too loud for Kate to understand.
"Repeat that," Kate asked, following Raoul into a narrow hallway beyond the door,
"and make it quick." "Hertzfeld," I said. "No last name, like Cher," said Banks. "I missed something. What are you talking about? Listen, this isn't the best. I put up a web page like we talked about, seeded with code words only someone familiar with the strange and recursions could have possibly have interpreted correctly. A guy named Hertzfeld saw the website and our secret message. He's a science geek type, maybe a touch autistic. Anyway, I've got Paldridge checking him out now to see if he's legit or just a crackpot who got lucky."
Kate whispered fiercely into the phone, cupping her hand over the mouth and receiver so Claudio wouldn't hear.
"You put up a web page describing all this?" Kate was appalled. "And we didn't talk about doing any such thing."
"Well, maybe it was Raoul and me who discussed it. If you've got internet, point your browser to the estatefoundation.org and tell me what you think."
Kate put her hand over the receiver and shot Raoul a poisonous look. Raoul looked confused and mouthed,
"What?"
She wanted to tell him this was all his fault, but Banks continued, possibly a bit defensive. "So, let me know, okay? We're not standing still up here while you guys are cleaning up code outbreaks in Brazil."
It was too late to worry about Liza Banks running with scissors without Kate around to, what, supervise? Truth be told, Banks had come around in a big way. Maybe it was time that Kate recognized that. Maybe everything didn't rest on her shoulders. The thought was kind of nice. She had to admit that their cause was incredibly important and was very much in need of competent help, as much as they could get. Kate finally said,
"That sounds great, Liza. Good thinking. Can't wait to meet Hertzfeld, if he checks out."
"Excellent. So how are things going in Brazil?"
"We're just about to find out." Claudio glanced around and nodded, obviously half listening to her conversation on the phone. He probably thought she was talking to her investment partners back in the U.S., so she said,
"Yes, Senor Rodriguez is a prince, like you said, Liza. I'll let you know how our preliminary look at the facility goes in an hour or so. So far, so good."
"He's listening, isn't he?" asked Liza.
"Yep."
Banks said, "Okay, bye, good luck," and hung up. What Kate assumed the woman had meant but didn't say was good luck destroying the facility.
"Goodbye."
Kate slipped her phone into her purse as Claudio led them up to another security check. This time, each of them had to submit to having their picture taken by a wall-mounted sensor, just to maintain a record of visitors, Claudio explained. Then they proceeded into a larger chamber, one with no other obvious exits. The chamber had been recently retrofitted. The detritus of quick construction was everywhere. Kate recognized electrical, phone, and data fiber cables, pallets filled with construction materials, and the smell of new paint once common to internet startups before the bubble burst.
"Sorry it's cold in here," said Claudio. "Several computer workstations mostly powered down except for one display featuring a Naturescapes screensaver were crammed around the edges of the room, leaving the center open." Claudio led them across the chamber towards the far wall.
"It's even colder in there where we've got the machine running," their guide gestured to a wide viewing window set in the wall.
Raoul and Kate moved up and peered through. A chunky piece of hardware was installed in a custom rack, occupying most of the sealed room. A subtle vibration, presumably from its operation, tickled Kate's soles. A jumble of cables splayed out from the base and slithered to various outlets and other ports along the walls.
Impressive, said Raoul. Claudio nodded. You want to see what it can do? His eyes sparkled with excitement.
That's why we're here, Kate said. The three gathered around one of the monitors. Claudio entered a password at the prompt too quickly for Kate to catch it.
A screensaver cleared, replaced by a clunky input interface.
Everyone who works in the field tells you that quantum computers are the secret to creating unbreakable encryption, began Claudio, who navigated through a series of menus as he talked, or maybe the secret of breaking normal encryption. He laughed, shaking his head. Others explain how quantum computing unlocks vast new processing power to use on various problems so that we can finally model complex rocket equations, actually predict weather, or make self-driving cars even safer.
That's mostly theoretical, said Kate. Lots of companies have made claims, but few have delivered anything. She was goading Claudio purposefully.
Claudio glanced at her and winked.
Watch this.
He tapped in a few more commands, and one of the screens next to him lit up. It showed what was apparently a real-time camera feed of the room in which they were standing. She looked around. She didn't see a camera. From the perspective, she figured it must be concealed over the door where they entered.
She waved, and her image on the screen waved in sync.
She said, I don't understand. You can control spy cameras with your computer?
Claudio laughed. No. Well, yes. Like I said, breaking normal encryption is theoretically pretty easy for us. But what true unlimited quantum computing actually offers is almost limitless processing power for use in simulations.
What you're looking at on the screen isn't a camera feed. It's a simulation I'm running on the computer based only on the real-time sound cues we're providing, a layout map of the lab, and the pictures I had the system take of us as we entered. It's extrapolating everything else. Isn't that incredible?
Extrapolating?
Like how I'm moving my right hand now? How I'm twiddling my hair? How could it possibly do that you're having us on?
Despite her protests, Kate's skin prickled. What if he was telling the truth?
With the right starting conditions, we can simulate and extrapolate in real time. It's uncanny. And as I'm demonstrating, worth your investment.
Raoul looked worried.
How far beyond this room have you extended this simulation?
How far would you like me to pull back? We've done some limited tests and have managed to simulate the first floor of the university, but hypothetically, we could increase the scope by an order of magnitude, maybe even more.
Kate said, I can't believe that a piece of hardware, however advanced, has the horsepower to accomplish even a fraction of that.
Before working on this project, I'd have agreed with you, said Claudio, but then we, learned of an entirely new way to control nuclear and electronic spins in diamond crystals. That allowed us to create a next generation of quantum computing chip. Now that it's running, it's almost as if we've tapped into some larger network. The more processing power we ask for, the more we get.
It reminded Kate of Carter's story. The one about his VR simulation going so disastrously wrong.
Shut it down, she said. We've seen enough.
But I was just... Raoul yelled, his old accent back. Turn it off, you fool. Every second it runs, we risk forging a permanent connection directly to the dark energy network.
Do as he says, a new voice behind them instructed. Shut it down. Then explain why you're running unsanctioned simulations in here, let alone with strangers present.
A bulky man in a suit stood in the center of the room. He wore red sunglasses. Pale amber light hazed the air around him, making the room behind him seem blurry and unreal. Claudio gasped.
"Mr. Coulson, I didn't know you were here today."
"Answer my question," replied the suit, taking a step closer. Kate reached for Malcolm before remembering she hadn't checked her pistol on the international flight. Too much could have gone wrong. Unfortunately, things were going wrong in a different fashion now. Claudio typed a command on the workstation keyboard, and the simulation on the screen died. Raoul, who obviously understood more than her, literally breathed a sigh of relief. Kate decided to ignore the haze for the moment. She addressed the newcomer with red shades. "Mr. Coulson, would I be correct in assuming you're the one who supplied the schematics to the university? Presumably you found those schematics somewhere online?" The man's scarlet gaze settled on her. Something about him was sort of familiar. His mouth quirked up one side of his face in a sardonic smile. "Nope. Claudio here found those himself. I only appeared on the scene, so to speak, after he turned on the machine the first time. Let's just say that I serve the interests of Jason Cole." "Who's Jason Cole?" asked Claudio. Everyone ignored him.
"Coulson, Jason Cole," hissed Kate. "It's you."
The man's features strongly resembled the face they'd all seen on the screen in Liza Banks' office, although not exactly.
"No.
Not the original, anyhow." Then she understood.
"You're another fucking copy," she accused.
She remembered how the man she'd encountered in the server room of BDR so many months earlier had slumped like hot candle wax into a slurry of pink goo. He'd been a sort of clone envoy of Jason from Ardeen. "So when are you going to melt?" He laughed. "Not gonna happen. Think I'd risk a trip and maybe end up the same way? Nope. Thanks to the new regime operating here, I'm every bit as real as you are. I've translated. Assuming Claudio doesn't fuck everything up."
"Hey," said Claudio. "We're going to shut you down," said Raoul.
Red glasses said, "Fine. We don't even need this place, not anymore. We've perfected translation initiation from our side.
Witness the mouth of this translation gate."
He gestured behind him. Kate's eyes flicked to the vertical hazing in the air.
Shit. Coulson was intimating that the light show was, what, some kind of physical gate into Ardeen? And that they could open gates back there and reality at will now?
"Why are you telling us this?" asked Raoul. "You know we're here to stop it."
"Because you can't stop it," Coulson said, "and I'm bored. You try talking only to yourself for decades at a stretch and tell me if it doesn't drive you insane with boredom."
"Listen," interrupted Claudio. "What the hell are you talking about, Coulson? What's this business with a translation gate, and what the hell is that?"
He pointed an accusatory finger at what Coulson called the translation gate. Coulson glanced at the university man.
"I'm not talking to you." Raoul said, "I'll tell you this for free, Coulson. You've got to keep this machine off and destroy it. Both Ardeen and Earth are vulnerable while it's on. Tell your boss he doesn't really understand what he's messing with."
Coulson shrugged. "Knowing Jason, and trust me, I know him, it's possible he doesn't understand. But it's a gamble we'll have to—"
Hey, said Claudio. "You're all having me on, right? What are you talking about? Where's Ardeen? Through the, gate?"
"For the love of Christ, shut up, man," Coulson told Claudio. "Can't you see I'm trying to have a conversation?" Coulson pulled a gun from his suit and shot Claudio. He swung back to Kate and Raoul.
"Now, where were we?"
Raoul yelled,
"Take cover!"
as he followed his own advice, ducking behind a monitor. Kate dove behind a workstation.
"Hey, now why'd you go do that?" Coulson yelled. "It was rude. Don't you want to talk anymore?"